Smith, I think you just slapped the shit out of me. Anyway, sorry. The guy that came here to speak to you today, I've been talking to him for probably almost a year on the phone, trying to find a date where it would work out. And you know, there's a page in the book that when I first got here, which was my first experience with this fellowship in AA, it was my favorite page. It had one sentence that made so much sense to me, and it says, "We are people who would normally not mix." And I was looking around in the line today, I said, "You're damn right." No, I'm just kidding. But I was talking to him yesterday on the way over here. You know, and that, on that same page, it talks about there's two things that bind us together, a common problem and a common solution. And another page in there is my favorite one. It says, "We're sure that God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free." And one thing he said to Chaz and Eric and I yesterday, he was talking about fishing and going out fishing with his son. And he said that sometimes he doesn't even bait the hook. He just puts it in the water and sits back on his chair and reads a book because he doesn't even want the fish to interrupt him. That's freedom. It was an amazing conversation. And this, and the other thing he talked about was service and giving back. And he's come all the way from Vista, California to get back and be of service. Kip.
Can you hear me now? Louder? Okay. My name's Kip Collins, and I'm an alcoholic. And I ain't had a drink all day long. I didn't hurt nobody today. Didn't hurt myself. I worked all week and paid my way. On the way home every single night this week, coming up my street, all my neighbors waved at me with all five fingers. That might not impress y'all, but it sure does tickle my mother. I'm real honored to be here. I didn't know if I first heard about this. I told my wife, I said, "You know what, I've just asked me to be the main speaker at this festival called Some Are Sicker Than Others." She goes, "That's about right." I said, "Well, Larry Scott spoke there." She goes, "That figures." It's good to see my old friend Larry here. I love that guy. I love him so much, I let him take care of my dogs, you know. Yeah, we got a lot of meetings under our belt together. I thank the staff for being up here, man, and I'll tell y'all something. You got something real special here, man. I've been to AA. Every state in the United States, 9 different countries, and every province of Canada, South America, and Central America. And you don't find this everywhere. You don't find this everywhere. This is special. You can feel it. It's called unity. Everybody's here and are on the same page, man. We're after the same thing. I didn't get here by accident. I didn't get here by no courts. I didn't get here by any wife or anyone threatening to fire me. I didn't come here because I wanted to quit drinking. I come here because alcohol quit. And I guarantee you, you know, my sobriety date's May 12th, 1984. And it would have been 2004 if I could have hung in there. I loved alcohol. I don't know what alcohol did for you, man, but good Lord, I had some good times. You know, I listened to you after you read The Promises, and I don't know what alcohol did for you folks. Every time I hear those promises read, man, it just instant nostalgia. Because that's what alcohol did for me. Every one of those steps came true every time I drank, you know. And when it stopped working and the promises of alcohol stopped working, talks about it in a vision for you. It says there'll come a time where you cannot imagine life with alcohol, and you can't imagine life with it. And you know, loneliness such few people can even imagine. And you come to the jumping off spot and you wish for the end, because there ain't nowhere left to go. My father's Irish and Sioux, and my mother's Irish and Choctaw. And my daddy liked to drink, and my mother liked to fight, you know, and none of that makes me an alcoholic. You know, average day at our house, you'd be sitting there waiting for the old man to come home, and be getting later and later and later pretty soon. My mama, she marched when she was mad. You could always say we had hardwood floors, you know, and you could hear her walking. And you knew. You could always tell her what was going on by the way she was walking, you know. About midnight, man, she is, the Nazi stormtroopers are there, you know. She is marching, you know, and pretty soon you hear that old pickup driving up the driveway, bouncing off the curbs. And Mom, you look outside about right then, you'd see all the neighbors coming outside, grabbing a lawn chair, trying to get a good seat, you know. And Daddy'd pull in the driveway, Mom'd fly out the front door, she'd go for the driver's door with a butcher knife, he'd bail out the passenger door, and they'd be chasing each other around, and the neighbors were cheering, you know, and that was just Monday night, you know, and there was nothing special. It's just the way it was, but I was never going to be an alcoholic. Me and my little brother, we'd lay in bed at night, we'd talk about it, me and my brother Bill, we were 11 months apart, and we talk about the kind of men we wanted to be when we grew up, kind of fathers we wanted to be, kind of husbands we wanted to be. Man, it wasn't anything like that man. We didn't want nothing he had. You know, I don't blame him at all. I can't blame my father. My father showed me exactly what alcohol will do to a marriage, what it'll do to children, what it'll do to a career. I have no illusions of what alcohol will do to a man. So I can't blame him, so I blame the San Diego Unified School District. You know, in the early 60s, they had this great idea. They're going to start bringing us young folks in and start teaching us about this stuff we don't talk about in A&A. And they brought us in this big room, man. They showed us this movie, and they got these guys come up and talked and told us what was going to happen to us if we did this. And they turned the lights back on. I hit my buddy Balto in the ribs. I said, can you get some of that? He says, yeah, my daddy smokes that stuff. And I said, oh, cool, hook me up. And I said, next day I said, you get it? He goes, yeah. I said, well, what do we do? He says, I'll meet you after school. I hooked him up after school. I said, so what do we do? He says, we got to go boost some wine. I said, boost some wine? Why? He goes, I don't know. But my daddy drinks wine with this every time. You know, we didn't want to make no mistakes, you know. Went down this little Lair's Market, and I stole a short dog of sweet red port, and he got a little bottle of Muscatel, and we went down this little canyon. He fired up that funny cigarette, and he took a hit off of it, and he passed it to me, and I took a hit off of it and started coughing. Tasted horrible. And I'm looking at this stuff, man. This stuff looks cool. It's got this real fancy screw cap bottle, you know, and I twisted that cap off. I took a big pull on it, and it hit my belly, and it bounced right out. Landed on my shoes. But I ain't no quitter, you know. I took another pull on her, you know, and started doing that yo-yo thing, you know. You gotta pinch your nose. And I held her down, you know. I took another pull on her, man. She started going down smooth. By the time I got finished with that short dog, man, it was just going down just smooth as glass, you know, and I'm look over at Balto, and he's squatting down. He's sucking on this little cigarette. And I go, Ma. I said, you're going to drink that? He says, oh, God, no, man. That stuff's horrible. I said, can I have it? He says, knock yourself out, man. And I took his. He was right. That Muscatel, man, it'll do in a pinch, but it. I drank it, though, you know. And right about the time I finished that, I laid back. It was a beautiful day in Southern California. Leaned back against this grassy bank, and I'm looking at the sky, and I had my very first spiritual experience. Now, I don't know what alcohol did for you. I lived in a neighborhood that was all first-generation Hispanic. Nobody spoke English. Everybody had dark brown skin, dark hair, dark brown eyes. My cousins lived with us. They're Indian. They had dark brown skin, dark brown eyes, dark brown hair. Me and my brother, we were born with white hair, white skin, and freckles. And we went outside, man, the Mexicans wanted to beat our ass. We went in the house, the Indians wanted to beat our ass, you know. We're standing in that doorway, I was afraid to go in or out. There was always excitement going on, man. There was a lot of violence in my neighborhood. There was a lot of violence in my home. And I grew up absolutely terrified, although I didn't even know it. It was such a part. It had been there always that I didn't even know it. But when I drank that liquor, and I'm laying there, all of a sudden, I said, what is this weird feeling? And I realized I wasn't afraid of anything. My skin fit. I knew I had a right to be here, you know? And it put a smile on my lips and a song in my heart. And I knew all about the first three steps long time before I knew about you folks. And when I was 12 years old, I knew I was powerless over this world and my life was unmanageable. I took a drink of this magic stuff and I came to believe there was a power greater than anything. And I immediately, with no reservation, turned my will and life over to it, and I never looked back. You know, about a couple of years later, I got kicked out of school for beating up a teacher for the second time. It was a misunderstanding. I had a lot of misunderstanding. Anybody here get here with misunderstandings? People judging you by your actions instead of your motives, you know? Yeah. A lot of judgmental people out there, you know? I came home and the school had called my mom and ratted me out, you know? And I'm walking up the house and she's standing there at that door. She's got this bag of this green vegetable matter in her hand. And she said, you got kicked out of school, huh? I said, yep. She goes, what's this? And I said, probably just what you think it is. She said, you get out of my house. I've been waiting for her to tell me that since I was 5 years old, you know? And I left. I mean, I didn't look back. I just said, yes, ma'am. And I split, and I went over to a friend of mine's house and over on the coast. And he said, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know what to do. And he says, well, check this out. This is about 1964. He says, all these folks are going up to San Francisco, and all they do up there is get high and listen to music and make love. When I was 14 years old, I was one music lover. I was almost obsessed with music. It was on my mind all the time. It wasn't until I was about 60, as a matter of fact. I went up to this place called Haight-Ashbury, and once more, I didn't fit in, you know. I've been fighting all my life. These people are all pacifists, you know. Someone says something to me, I knock them out, and they keep going, give peace a chance, you know, and I'm going, I don't know what you people are talking about. But I found my true calling, you know. I found out what God intended me to be. I am a capitalist pig, you know. And I saw opportunity. I saw all these white kids that didn't know what time of day it was. They wanted this stuff. They come from the suburbs. You know, they got money. I called my buddy Balto. I said, Balto, you're not going to believe what these people pay for this stuff up here. And he goes, come on down. And we went down to Mexico and talked to his family, and we started a little business, import business. And I worked for that family for a long, long, long time. I got arrested in Mexico when I was 16 years old with 200 kilos of green vegetable matter. And they sentenced me to 25 years in prison, La Mesa Federal Penitentiary. And they walked me into that prison, and I was just a kid. I had long blonde hair and blue eyes and white skin, weighed about 110. I'm walking in this prison, man, and it sounds scary, don't it? Nah. I'm God's favorite child, man. I got to that prison, I didn't know what was going to happen, but Balta was related to half the people in that prison. And I'd been working for them all along, man, and I walked in that door, man, they just said, come on, Kip, you're with us, you know, and those guys gave me my schooling. I got my PhD in criminology in there, and I learned about willing to go to any lengths. I learned about commitment. I learned about honor. I learned about a lot of things that you don't learn out here on the streets. And those were good people, let me tell you. They were good people. And I worked for that family for a long time. You know, I love Mexico. It works on the principle of mordida, which is the only civilized way to live. You know, it basically bribes. You know, mordida in Spanish means a little bite. You know, and you give someone, basically, you know, I don't care what you do. If you got enough money, you can do it on live TV and walk away from it, you know. And we found the right amount of money, called my brother. I said, bring me $5,000, and he brought it down. We paid off this guy. They let me out, and I went right back to work. And, you know, and I got arrested when I turned 18, 27 felonies. I was living with this gal, and she was pregnant. We were real excited about this baby, and they came in at 5:30 in the morning when I turned 18 and took me down. I was locked up for about a year and a half fighting that case. Finally beat it, but you know, I never got to see that girl. She didn't return my calls. She didn't get returned. My letters were returned. I never heard nothing from nobody. And when I got out of there, I finally beat it. And I got out and I went to go look for her, and the family told me to get away, stay away from her. You done enough damage to our family. And I asked them about the child. They wouldn't tell me nothing about the child. They said, you just stay away from us. And I respected that, and I left, you know, and I left a big hole in my gut, though. You know, about that time, this company called Roar came out with this product. And anybody here ever gone to jail for just being stupid in public? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. There's seven honest people and a bunch of liars here. I took these things, man, and I didn't do anything criminal. I just do the stupidest damn things right in front of God and everyone. I brought that rain in the cloud for you, Larry. You comfortable, brother? Need anything? All right. Look out, you folks are so sweet, you'll melt in that rain. Now I got to start all over. Want to wait till you get settled, or y'all just get settled, get out of the rain, get somewhere. Lightning's coming any minute, it's going to get one of you. Probably Larry. Put that over Larry's head. Okay, everybody comfortable now? And I've been running around with this little gal, man. She, and every time I went to jail three times in 1 week. And every single time I'd just get to my bunk and they'd say, roll up, you've been bailed out. And this little 15-year-old girl, she just kept bailing me out of jail. And the last time she did it, I said, how come you keep bailing me out of jail? And she looked at me with those big brown eyes and said, well, what else should I do? So I married her, you know. Kathy was one of the greatest crime partner I ever had in my life, man. She would come from a real rich family, but she was game for anything. And we had a lot of fun. You know, I got busted. I went back. I did another year on another beef, and I got back out, and I had this really unreasonable parole officer. He wanted me to get a job. I told him I had one. And, you know, I couldn't work with this guy at all, so I got my case transferred up to Oregon. We went up there, and we were up there for about a week, and my wife informed me that she was pregnant. And, you know, that was a real life-changing event for me. I made a decision right then and there. My life, I'd done whatever I wanted to do for a long time. But in my heart of hearts, what I always wanted to be more than anything in this world was a father. I wanted to have the kind of life I dreamed about having when I was laying in that bed listening to my parents go crazy. I wanted to have a woman who loved me. I wanted to have a child. I wanted to have a boy to go fishing with. I wanted to do all those things I dreamed about doing. You know, when she told me she was pregnant, man, I made a decision that I was going to get out of that world. I was going to start living right and doing things right. And I did. I went to work out in the woods. I started logging. Had a really good job. I was making really good money, and I was real healthy. I quit using. I quit drinking. I quit doing anything, and I just spent with my wife and my kid. You know, not my kid wasn't born yet, but one day we went down to North Bend, Oregon to have the baby, and they took her in this one room, and they put me in another room, and after a while, they brought this little boy out, and they put that little boy in my arms, and I had my second spiritual awakening when they put that boy in my arms. I've never experienced an emotion like that in my life. It was like an electric shock. The minute I touched him, the minute I saw him, my heart exploded in my chest. I felt absolutely, totally head over heels in love. Absolutely, totally unconditional. I can't even explain it. And I held that baby and I cried and I promised him, I said, man, you're gonna be my pal. I'm gonna protect you. You're never gonna be afraid of nothing. You're gonna have all the stuff, man. And it's gonna be me and you. And I meant it with everything I had. We got out of that hospital, you know, and I got off parole up there, and I came back down to California. I got offered a real good job in construction down in California. We came back down here, and my wife got pregnant again. We went to this hospital, and I sat out there the same way, and after a while, they brought this little girl, and they dropped her in my arms, and the same thing happened. Man, my heart exploded in my chest. I fell in love with this child. You know, I'm holding her, and I'm looking at her, and I'm realizing this is a female. And you know, I'm an alcoholic. I think real fast. I'll be sitting in an A&A meeting, and one of you pretty girls will walk in. We'll fall in love, get married, have a couple of kids. You'll cheat on me with that old timer. I hate your guts. You haven't even got to your chair yet, you know? I can live a lifetime while you're walking across the room, you know. And I'm looking at this girl, and I'm going, someone's going to marry this, want to marry this girl someday. Where am I going to have the wedding? What shall I wear? And I'm planning out this wedding. I know exactly where I'm going to do it, you know, and it's going to put the, you know. And the lady's going, can I have the baby? We have to weigh her, you know. And I got her whole future planned out. But I held her and I promised her that she'd be my princess, and I promised her, and I gave her my word, and I meant it with everything I had. You know, things in my life, I had made a lot of money in my life, and most of it illegally, and I had a real nice place, and the next 5 years, my life was ideally, I drank on special occasions. I was always very cautious, because I always did stupid things when I drank. You know, I noticed that right off the bat. It was just, you know, it was something happened every time I drank. So I was really careful about when I drank. I didn't want to drink around my kids. I didn't want to affect anything. And it was absolute, total controlled drinking. And my life was about my kids. One day, September 6th of 1976, I was playing with my son. My wife and daughter were out. School closed. School was getting ready to start. And it was a real hot day. And we're out in the yard playing Frisbee and having fun. And fella came over, and we smoked this stuff, you know, and it was real hot that day. Man, I just got real, real thirsty. And I went in the house. I didn't have no beer. And I told my son, I said, you know, wait here. I'm going to be right back. I didn't have the car. All I had was my bike, and I got on my bike, and I putted up to the store to go get a six-pack. And no one else was there. And, I came back down. When I'm coming down the hill, I can see all the neighbors out in front of the house. And the fire department's coming, and the police is coming, and I waded through those people, and I found out my son had chased me out of the driveway. He'd been run over by a pickup truck. And when I got to him, his head was split open, and I could see his brains. And there was bones protruding out of his chest and his legs. And something inside of me died. I sat in that with the hospital intensive care with that little boy for 9 months. And every day I prayed to God to give me back my son. And every day I'd go in there and talk to those doctors, and they'd tell me to pray that he died because there was nothing to hope for. There was so much brain damage. There was absolutely no possibility of any kind of recovery. I don't know nothing about God, but I was out there trying to make a deal. I'd say, I'll do anything if you give me my son back. And, you know, my son, his body lived. And actually, he made medical history. He lived. He went through over 27 major brain surgeries. And he mentally and emotionally never got past the age of about 4, and he couldn't hear and he couldn't talk. And he had a lot of physical problems and psychological problems. In the middle of all this, my brother, Bill, who had been my best friend, my brother lived with me. We always lived together. We backed each other's play, right or wrong, under any odds or any conditions. There was never any conditions between me and him, you know. And he came down with a disease he called schizophrenia, and my family had him locked up in a hospital. And he called me from that hospital. He said, get me out of here, Kip. Get me out of here, man. Do whatever you got to do. Get me. I said, are you okay? He says, yeah, they're giving me these pills. Just get me out of here. You know, and I went against the family, the doctor, everybody, but I got my way. I got my brother out of there, and I brought him home, you know. And you know, I needed to make some money. My son's medical bills, they don't come in an envelope. They're coming in cardboard boxes, you know. And I got to make some money. And I call my friends in Mexico, and I tell them the deal, and I got to put something together. And we put this deal together, and I told my brother, I said, man, I got to go to New York. I'll be back in about 3 days. We got to make some money here. And my brother was looking at me. He said, you can't go. I said, why not? He says, I don't know, man. He says, I'm coming apart. Something's wrong. And I said, Bill, you know the deal, man. I've already committed. I can't back out. I got to go. You know the deal. And he says, I know, but Kip, he says, I don't know what's going to happen. I just don't feel right. And I gave my brother a handful of money. Money's been fixing stuff all my life. And I said, man, just hang tight, man. I said, I'll be bound 3 days. And whatever it is, me and you will do it like we always have. I said, just watch the kids. You know, watch my daughter. Take care of her while I'm gone. And I got in this cab, and I looked at my brother, and he was crying. And I never seen my brother cry before. And I got back to New York, and these Yankees, oh, man, what a mess. The thing, simple little thing turned into a real dilemma, and it took 3 weeks to put this package together. And I got back and got out of that cab, and my daughter was waiting. I said, where's my brother? She goes, I haven't seen him. I said, what do you mean you haven't seen him? She goes, he disappeared just a little while after you left. I said, no. And he says, yeah. My brother had a little mobile home right across the creek from my place, and we walked over there, and I knew before I got there. But I opened that door anyway, and my brother's head rolled out. 3 days after I left, he'd taken a shotgun and blown his head off. There was just a big pile of maggots laying in that doorway. And something inside of me completely snapped. I don't tell you any of this because I want to shock you. I want you to feel sorry for me. I like to drive home a very, very pertinent point. Chapter 5, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a sentence there that gets read at all meetings. People kind of giggle and laugh, you know. Some people don't pay attention to it, but it says those among us who got here with grave emotional and mental disorders. And I am one of those people. But I can tell you this from my heart of hearts, that I am so grateful. I am so grateful that God made me an alcoholic. Because if it wouldn't have been for alcohol, I would have joined my brother. But alcohol does something magic to me. Alcohol takes away guilt instantly. It gets rid of those pictures that are branded right on the front of my brain. Makes them a little foggy. Allows me to lay down at night and get a little bit of sleep. Stops the screaming when I get up in the morning. I know how to handle situations that before would have baffled me. It covers that whole rampant for me. All of those promises would come true every time I take a drink. And I'm drinking more. I'm drinking around the clock now, man, because it hurts. Thank you. A little to the left. Guy came over, my wife had left. She ran off with the coke connection. I didn't blame her. I wasn't paying her no attention. I'm locked in my own pain. My little girl's crying. Everyone's, you know, her life had been ideal, and all of a sudden, her brother's gone. Her uncle, who she adored, is gone. Her mother's gone. I'm acting nuts, and she's crying. She's going, Daddy, Daddy, what's going to happen? What's going on? Everybody's leaving. People are dying. You're acting crazy. What's going to happen to me? And I got her in my lap, and I said, baby, I said, we just hit a bump in the road. I don't need nobody. I said, you're just you. You're all I need. And you don't have to worry about nothing. I'm going to catch my breath here in just a minute, and everything's going to be okay. I ain't going to let nothing happen to you. Don't worry. And I got her calmed down, and I put her to bed. And about that time, a guy came over, and he brought this magic stuff that just changed my life one more time. I don't know if you guys have heard about it, and if there's anyone new here, and you don't want what we got, and you think liquor might be a wetter, I highly recommend this. In California, we call it Mad Dog 2020. Mad Dog 2020 is an event drink. Something will happen. You will have an event in your life, I guarantee you. You get your money, you get your dollars worth every single time, you know? I never heard of this stuff. I drank it, you know, and the next thing I know, this lady's saying, excuse me, sir, you got to get off the airplane. I said, the airplane? I'm looking around, man. I'm on this big wide-body jet. It's completely empty except for me and my little girl, you know. She's sound asleep. I said, where the hell am I? She said, you're in Fort Lauderdale. I said, Florida? She goes, yeah. I said, I hate Fort Lauderdale. She goes, I don't know nothing about it, man. You got to get off the plane, you know. And I don't have any clue. I was sitting in my living room the last time I checked, you know. So, you know, my daughter's 5. She probably knows what's going on, you know. So I was very casual, you know, because you got to look good, you know. And I wake her up. I said, we're here. She looked out the window, and she goes, oh, goody. And I went, that's all she said. I said, well, let's go. I ain't got a clue what you to do next, you know. So I did. I know what Dennis would have done, you know. I called a cab. I said, take me to a nice hotel and stop at a liquor store. I need to figure out what's happened here. And I come to butt naked, 4-point restraints on this gurney. And for just a minute, I thought I might have missed something really cool, you know. But it was a misunderstanding. I'd met this young couple in there, and they were in there partying in a room right across from us, and we had hooked up, and I was drinking tequila, they were drinking Jack, and they had this local Floridian additive, man, that you could really drink with this stuff, and we were just ripping and tearing. We drank their liquor, we drank my liquor, we ran out of their additive, and we all wanted more, and I said, y'all ever heard of Mad Dog 2020? They hadn't. I felt like a missionary, you know? And allegedly, I was down in the lobby of this really nice hotel, butt naked, about 3 o'clock in the morning, trying to introduce myself to some young lady. I'm from Southern California. That ain't no big deal, you know. But you people in the South are really uptight, man. And they called the cops. Cops didn't know what to make of me. They just maced me, beat me down like they always do, and they took me to the jail. I was so nuts, they ended up taking me to county mental health. They gave me some of that magic Thorazine and calmed my butt right down. And I came to the next morning. I woke up in that place, and I'm, you know, I knew I was in trouble at first, though. I saw the color of the walls, green. You wake up in an all-green room. You weren't walking a little old lady across the crosswalk the night before, I guarantee you. Especially if it's got bars on the windows. That's a bad sign. I talked to this doctor, and I told him about the trauma I'd been in. This is a ball big mistake, and you know, and I just got here, and man, if you will let me out of here, I guarantee you I will not let the sun set on me in the state of Florida. And he said, good, get out of here. I don't know where my kid is. I haven't mentioned her, because you don't want to bring that into the picture. You know, they might call the cops. I haven't got a clue where she is, but I'll find her, you know. And I'm hoping I got a matchbook or something from the hotel or some kind of, but you know, I'm getting dressed. I walk outside, and here comes that young couple with my little girl. She runs up, jumps in my arm. I said, come on, baby, we're getting out of Florida. I told you this place sucks. And I'd love to tell you, man, that was it, but that was the beginning of a very long, long trip, and I ain't gonna go into all of it. I'll just tell you this, that for the next 3 years, that's the way we lived. It never was any different. It got worse and worse. And it was my good Freddie out in Alabama. He says, "You got worse and worse and worse." You know, I lived in 5 different states all through the South. And every place I lived, I left in a dead run. I promised my daughter everywhere we went that I was going to get her in school. You know, I was going to get a job. We're going to get a place. And, you know, I had full of good intentions. But you know what? I only know how to live one way. And I'd resort right back to the only thing I know how to do. And I'd get back in there, man, and, you know, we'd have to leave. Something had happened. We'd be on that midnight bus. And the last place was in Oklahoma City. My family had taken us in, you know, and real good Christian folks. Just a wonderful, wonderful family. We met them on the bus running out of Georgia. And he said, you know, you can come in and we'll let you get your daughter in school. And you got a little house there at the ranch. You all can stay and have your own little place. And you can work for my dad. And we'll get you involved in our church. And we'll help you get your life together. And they were just good, good people. He says, but you can't drink on the ranch. We don't drink. And I went, whoa. My daughter was crying. She's going, Daddy, please, please, please. And I, you know, I couldn't turn her down. I said, all right. And I went there and I went to work for this man and I didn't drink for a week. I was sicker than a dog. It was hotter than hell out there. And on Friday, my little girl's so excited. She's got little kids to play in with. She's got the little pony she's playing with, you know, and they're getting ready to get her involved in school. And she went to church with them and she's just, they bought her a little Sunday school dress and she was just loving it, man. This lady was taking such good care of her. And we got paid on Friday, and the guy I worked with out there, he says, hey, I'm going to go into town, cash my check. You want to come with me? I'll buy you a beer. I ain't got to tell you what happened. You know exactly what happened. I come in late that night, and I got blood on my clothes, and it ain't mine. And my little girl is looking at me, and she sees, she knows. She's been sitting there waiting for me. She just stands up and she grabs an old bag and puts some clothes in it and grabs that raggedy old doll and her raggedy old pillow and she's standing and I change clothes and grab a couple of things and we run out and we steal that man's pickup truck. Get to the bus station. I get a bottle of wine and 2 tickets to California. Say, I'm going back to California, baby. And I got drunk, passed out of the back of the bus. I come to in Albuquerque, New Mexico, sicker than a dog, man. I was so sick and I woke up and my little girl was sitting there in her seat and she was just rocking back and forth, holding her stomach. And I said, what's the matter? She said, Daddy, I'm so hungry, you haven't fed me. And I said, as soon as we stop, I'll get you something to eat. You know, we stopped in Albuquerque and I got off that bus sicker than a dog. I went in this liquor store, I got her a little sandwich, got me a bottle of wine. I got it to pay for it and I only had money for one or the other and I had to put her sandwich back. I've done a lot of things in my life that are very shameful. I've never done anything in my life that shames me more than that moment. It shames me to stand here and tell you about it. There was an elderly black lady sitting on that bus right across from us, and she's a wonderful woman. She said, never said a word to me, never looked at me, never gave me a dirt, said one thing. She just looked at my little girl because I walked right past my daughter. I couldn't sit with her. Went to the back of the bus with that brown paper bag, scooted down low on the seat. No one could see me and just laid there and drank. But that lady told my little girl, I could hear, she says, honey, she goes, my daughter just made me this big meal to eat on the way. I'm going to California. She goes, would you mind riding with me? I just hate sitting alone and help me eat some of this food. And that gal, she took care of my little girl all the way back to California. God bless her wherever she is. We got back to California. I did what all heroes do at the end of the road, went to mom's house. You a little bit about my mom. My mom suffers from Alzheimer's and I've been taking care of her for a long, long time now. And I love my mama. Well, that is the meanest woman you have ever met in your life. I saw her stab my daddy 3 different times. One time a neighbor was yelling at me about something. She snuck up behind him and knocked him cold with a shovel. Gotta respect a woman like that. I mean, you gotta respect a woman like that. Her talk ain't cheap. She took one look at me with a look I've never seen her give anyone, including my dad. And she looked at her granddaughter, and she hadn't heard from us for almost 3 years. Didn't know if we were dead or alive. And she looked at her granddaughter, who was just the greatest thing that had ever happened to her. Man, she loved that little girl. And she's standing there, and she's dirty, and she's got long, raggedy hair, and this raggedy old dress, holding on to this raggedy old doll. She looked at me with a hate. I've never seen her look at anyone. She grabbed her granddaughter and pulled her in her house. She goes, "You ever come near me or her again, I'll kill you. Get off my property." And she meant it, you know, and she took my girl, thank God. You know, our next 3 years, I don't know a lot about it. You know, it's I hear y'all talk about blackouts a lot. I had whiteouts. I was in a blackout for almost 3 years, and but I would come to once in a while. Be like this, you know. Just like right now, everyone's looking at you, and you're going. And then it would fade to black. And you'd be somewhere else, and you're going, and everyone's looking down at you. A little bit farther. Should move a little bit, Larry. And I was a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot. I lived in a bamboo bush down in the, right on the Pacific Ocean, underneath a restaurant, and their septic tank drained in that bamboo patch, and nobody would go in there because it smelled so bad. And right across the Pacific Coast Highway, there was a little biker bar and a 7-Eleven. I'd go over there and I'd panhandle for wine. I'd get enough bottle of wine, I'd hobble back to my bush and I'd drink. And if I couldn't get no wine or I got sick, I'd stand in front of that door of that little biker bar till someone ordered a drink and went to the bathroom, and I'd run in as quick as I could and drink it before someone beat the hell out of me, you know. And that's the way I lived. You know, I lived that way, and it was just all one just big giant blur. I know after I got sober, I had to do some exhaustive work, and I was arrested on that one corner 52 times for drunk in public. I know that I was in county mental health 9 different times, and I know I was admitted to the Tri-City Hospital a number of times. Those are the only things that I knew because it was all written down and someone else did it. If I would have known I was going to have to come here and tell you about it, I would have taken notes, but I don't know what the hell happened, man. I was standing out in front of that 7-Eleven one morning. I was sicker than a dog. I've gone into seizures many times right on the street because I can't get a drink. And I am physically addicted to alcohol. I cannot stop drinking. If I stop drinking, I start shaking, I'll go into a grand mal seizure, and I'll be doing the bonita right on the sidewalk, and then they'll have to take me and they'll detox me again, and I'll have to go start the whole thing all over again. Because I ain't stopping drinking, man. Nothing works. And I knew I was getting ready to go into a seizure, man, and I couldn't even panhandle. It was early in the morning, and I was so sick, and I was shaking. And this guy pulled up, man, they pull up, and there's this square-looking dude and short hair and suit, and four-door sedan with this square little wife sitting there and square little kid sitting in the back. And I just couldn't figure out how they could live like that, but, you know, who am I to judge? And that man got out of that car and he walked up to me and he said, "God bless you, sir. Will this help you out?" And he gave me $2 $1 bills. I knocked him down getting into that store, man. Got me a quart of wine and a short dog. I got outside that store. I put that short dog straight down and just leaned against that cold glass. And the shaking started to stop. And I opened my eyes and I could see the reflection in that glass right behind me. Those folks, that family sitting in that car. And they were all looking at me and they were all talking, and I knew they were judging me. And I turned around, flipped them off and cursed them and went back to my bush. And I'm laying down in that bush, man, and I'm sucking that bottle of wine. And all of a sudden, man, I don't know if it was an audio hallucination. I don't know what. I don't know if someone yelling on the bank. I don't know. But what I heard was, maybe you ought to go to A&A. I've been to A&A, you know, detoxes. And, we got a real active AA group where I live in Carlsbad, California. There's always someone with 90 days going to rescue my ass, you know, and get me a big book. And they're going to love me till I can love myself and all that shit. And, you know, and I'd look at him just total disgust. I said, "I ain't no alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I just can't afford any drugs right now." Well, we all know drug addicts are much classier than alcoholics, you know. They laughed just like that, you know. They said, yeah. Well, you find yourself drinking, you can't stop drinking, why don't you come to A&A? I ended up in this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in a whiteout. I was sitting there, and all of a sudden, I was at the back of this large meeting, and all of you people appeared, and you were looking at me, and I'm looking at you, and there was a guy at a podium just like this, and he said, are you looking for AA? And I looked at the guy. I've lost the ability to talk. I mean, I can't talk no more. I have absolute epiphanies thinking about, you know, but if I get nervous, it gets stuck somewhere between my brain and my mouth, and it just kind of, they said, would you like to identify yourself? And I looked at him, and I went, ah. He just got a big smile. He said, welcome, have a seat, you know. You know, these people are all clean up, man. They're all looking good. They're smelling good, you know. They're smiling and laughing and joking. And I've been living in the same clothes for 3 years. You know, my hair comes down way past my ass. My beard comes down to my belly button. I got a lot of things crawling on me that don't belong there, you know. And a guy says, there's something moving on your face. I said, leave it alone. It eats the freckles, man. And, I'm sitting there, man. I'm listening to these people talk, and man, I'm so embarrassed for you people. The things you people talk about, man, you just give up your stuff right in front of God and everything, you know. And you're talking about God, you know, and I don't need your God. You know, I saw you pass a basket. I know you're going to start singing any minute, you know, and I'm going, man, this is the lamest thing I've ever been in my life. Let me out of this place. And there was this one gal, she kept looking at me from the minute I walked in that room. She kept trying to catch my eye, little old gal, tiny little thing. And this guy started talking about some kind of lofty stuff. Man, I said, that's it, I'm out of here. And I got up to leave, and that lady stood up and saved my life. She cut that guy off cold, man. She started walking towards me, and she says, son, she goes, don't leave. Please, please, don't leave. She says, listen here. Because I walked in these rooms 27 years ago in Long Beach, California. Cops brought me in. I didn't want no part of this. They brought me in here, man, and I saw it out in a meeting, and I looked at all these squares, man. I looked at them. I knew when they saw me and saw what I was, they were going to run me off. They didn't want me around their men. I've been working the streets of Los Angeles since I was 13 years old, and I've done everything a woman had to do to survive out there. And when I saw y'all, I felt dirty, and I wanted to leave. And I started to leave, but a woman grabbed me and said, baby, don't go nowhere. We need you. And that woman came up there, man, and she whispered. She started talking all the time, talking about 27 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, talking about a sponsor who took her through the steps, who changed her life, a sponsor who got her hooked up with a group of women in a women's meeting and taught her how to be a lady, talked about a career, talked about tragedies. And she finally got up right up next to me, man, because I was just mesmerized. And she grabbed me and she pulled my face right down. She woman kissed me right on the mouth. The bravest woman I've ever met in my life. And she grabs hold of my neck and she pulls my head down, man. And she's squeezing on my neck. She whispers in my ear. She says, baby, don't go nowhere. We need you desperately. Please don't leave. You know, people have been beating on me all my life. Ain't nobody ever made me cry over nothing. And this old gal standing there, she's squeezing the life out of me right in front of the PTA, whispering that stuff in my ear. Man, my eyes started fogging up. My belly started rumbling. I'm standing there. I am crying like a little schoolgirl right in front of y'all. And I started coming to A&A. And a lot of you lied to me right from the very beginning. You said the most horrible thing you can tell a real alcoholic. You told me that just go to meetings and don't drink. I'd be fine for a problem drinker. See, alcohol is not my problem. I have an acute allergic reaction to sobriety. In God's name, I have no idea why anybody would really ever want to feel like that all the time. Everything's so real, you know? How in the hell do you sleep? What about them? You know, Chucky. You guys know Chucky? Yeah, we all got a Chucky. And I kept coming to A&A meetings. I'd go to speaker meetings, man. I'd go to all those meetings, and I'd sit with those people, and I'd learn their little lingo, and I'd hang with them as long as I could. I'd go to coffee with them. I'd do this with them. I'd do that with them. They tell me I had to get a sponsor. I'd ask what that is. They explained it to me, and I said, no, thanks. You know, they told me I got to take these steps. I looked at those steps. None of them applied to me, you know. First one says I'm powerless. You know, I've been carrying a gun since I was 14 years old. I ain't powerless, believe me. Said my life's unmanageable. Who in the hell really wants to know what's going to happen next? Come on. You know? I like leaning against the wind, you know? Talked about insanity. I started seeing a psychiatrist when I was 10 years old because I almost killed a kid for stealing a Coke bottle from me. So you always been nuts. What are they going to restore you to? You know, that one confused. They talked about God. I cried out to you people's God a million times. Your God never cut me no slack. I cried out to God in those prisons, man. He didn't cut me no slack. I cried out to God for my son. I cried out for my brother. Nobody ever cut me no slack. God don't like people like me. He likes those people who live up in the suburbs. People like me just piss him off. He had nothing coming and neither did I, and I knew it. And I didn't want nothing to do with your God. Talked about this inventory. I haven't really gone into it a lot, and I ain't going to. But I was a professional criminal for the most of my life. And I prided myself on no paper trails of any of my activities. Now you want me to write everything I've ever done down and share it with the PTA. I don't think you people would understand, you know. I really don't think you would understand. And if I tell you, I'm going to have to kill you, you know. Talked about these defects. I have no idea what that even means. But then that next one said, what does amend mean? Well, you got to face everyone you've ever harmed and make it right. I fell out of my chair laughing. I can see it now. Loopy, don't shoot, man. Give me a break. Hey, brother, I'm sorry I shot you, your brother, and your dog and took all your stuff. But I'm a spiritual manner of living today. And I'm here to make things right. Man, I can just hardly wait to jump on that one. And that's one of the easy ones, you know. I went, no thanks, you know. And, you know, I wanted what you people had. Not all of you today. But there was people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I kept coming to those meetings. I'd see something. I couldn't put my finger on it. And it was a look in their eye, some of them, and the way they walked, the way they carried themselves. The way when they smiled and looked at you, they looked you right in your eyes. And there was a little twinkle going on. You could see it, just a little sparkle, just something a little special about these people. And all these people talked about the same stuff. They talked about this power that they had found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just kept coming, and I just kept coming, but I could not do what you wanted me to do. I could not do it. And I'd stay sober as long as I could, and I'd have to drink or blow my brains out. And I did this for a number of years, and at the end of my drinking, you know, I come to Christmas morning, 1983, in a butt naked, hog tied, in a padded room. Fake cops had beat me down, broke both cheekbones real bad, and I'd been bleeding, and my face was stuck to that rubber mat, you know, and it was just another day in paradise. And trying to peel my face off that mat, and I finally roll over, and I look at the cops. They're looking in the portholes laughing at me. Knew Santa Claus wasn't coming. You know, and they let me out of there. I was there all the time. They said, Kip, we'll see you later. Merry Christmas. Get out of here. And they gave me my stuff, and I made a conscious decision that day. I said, I can't go back to AA. I'm tired of raising my hand. I'm tired of being you people's token drunk. You know, this don't work for me. The only thing that never lied to me was liquor. Only thing in this world that takes away that pain is liquor. The only thing that takes away that alcoholic loneliness. That alcoholic loneliness so all-consuming that it would have been a tangible thing. It would have absolutely eaten me alive. And I started drinking, man, and I come to on January 6th. And the most horrible thing that have ever happened in my life happened. That liquor stopped working. Liquor stopped working. My body was as physically drunk as a human being can possibly be. But my mind was absolute, totally crystal clear. And that is a horrible, horrible place to be. And the vision for you, when you come to that spot, and you've been coming to AA, and all of a sudden you decide AA don't work for you, and you go back on out there, and that day the liquor stops working, you're going to know what the word lonely means. You're going to come to that jumping off spot. You're going to grab your gun. You're going to put it up to your heart. And you're going to pull the trigger with no hesitation. And that's what I did. And it blew my left lung and two ribs out. And knocked me all the way across the room. And I'm sliding down this wall, blood pumping everywhere, man. And the only thought I had was, thank God this nightmare's over with. I don't care what happens. I don't care where I'm going. I don't care. Just get me out of here. I can't go on another day. Another day. I cannot go one more day. And I come to in this hospital. You thought I died, didn't you? Huh? Shit. Yeah. I hear that. For me to drink is to die. I go, man, only if you're lucky, you know? I guarantee you, I haven't had a drink in 26 years, but in the last 26 years, if you could have given me a guarantee that I would have died if I drank, I would have drank. And that's a fact. I won't die. I'll be 199-year-old wino. A short dog will be 97 cents, and I'll have 96. And none of you will kick down, you know? And that's the way it will be forever and ever and ever. And I know that. This old man, Charlie Tuck, I hated his guts. He came into a meeting one time, man. He's one of those old guys, man. He always wore a suit, you know, tie, short hair, wingtips. He said, I'm a grateful alcoholic. I said, how long you been here? He said, when I got here, they only had one A. He got dead in my face. He went to my... says, son, he says, you think you're pretty tough, don't you? I looked him right in the eye, and I gave him my best mad dog look. I said, listen, old man, I'm tough enough. Don't you ever doubt that. He got this big grin on his face. He got his face right up in me, man. And he says, son, he says, let me tell you something. He says, you ain't tough. You're the scaredest son of a bitch in here. And I grant you, that might make you dangerous. But it sure don't make you tough. And he walked away laughing at me. I avoided that man like the plague. I go to an A&A meeting, I'd look in all the windows, make sure he wasn't there. But I'll tell y'all something, when I got sober and I did my inventory and when I got to my fears, the fear that had run my life, I was scared to death of you men. Terrified, absolutely terrified. What I was really afraid of was that you would see the fear. And I will do anything in this world to prove to you I am not afraid of you. I'll gunfight, I'll knife fight, I'll do anything we gotta do, but I'm tougher than you. And inside I would be dying. And that man saw it and he knew it right out, man. And I was like opposite poles, man. I was like that, you know. But I had everybody else buffaloed, you know. Didn't scare him. And he come in there, and I thought I was dead, man. You know, and I'd been in a coma for a long time, I guess. And everything had been black. And all of a sudden, I hear this deep, gravelly voice. I thought, oh, man, this is it, you know. And I open my eyes. I'm looking for that bright light. And there's this old fool standing at the foot of my bed with this big book and a these two dumb newcomers, eyes as big as saucers, looking at me. Oh, God, I died, I gone to hell, and this is it. Chained to a gurney, man, with this old fool preaching A&A for all eternity to me, you know? And I went, oh, no. And Charlie looked at me, man, and he didn't say a word to me. He put his arms around these two young fellas. He says, fellas, I want you to pay attention. Get up here real close. Look at this fella. Look at all those tubes coming out of his body. God damn. Look at his eyes. Look at that. Smell him. Good Lord. Come back over here. And they come back over and scamper up to him like little puppies, you know. And he says, I want you guys to pay attention. Pay attention to this fella. Because this is what happens to an alcoholic who refuses to take the steps. Come on, let's go. And they left. I felt cheap and used. You folks, we'll use you. We'll use you one way or the other. We'll say, see that guy Larry? Anyone can get sober. See that guy that drowned in his own puke? That's what's gonna happen to you. I like Larry's end better. I got out of that, you know, I was in the hospital for a long time. And I got out of that hospital about the beginning of May. And liquor didn't work, dope didn't work, man. I wanted to die. I was so lonely. I was so scared. I can't go to AA. I ran out of friends and enemies at about the same time. Nobody cared if I lived or died. The state of California was in the process of making me a ward of the state at 36 years old. And I didn't know what to do, man. I was trying to drink, and drink wouldn't work. Nothing would work. Nothing would take away that pain, that loneliness, that absolute terror. And I come to on May 12th, 1984, the same way I've come to 1,000 times. I come to, and usually the very first thought that hits my brain is get something in you now. Get something in your body quick before it starts, before the screaming starts. That's my very first conscious thought, is to try to get out immediately. It don't work no more, but I ain't got no other choices. Nothing else works. I can't be sober. I can't be in this thing I live in. And I've been to so many of these A&A meetings, y'all, it's poisoned my mind, man, because I'm laying there sicker than a dog needing a drink more than anything in this world. And what comes to my head ringing in my ears is what's read at the end of chapter 5, the ABCs. It says, no, I'm an alcoholic. Now, I know I've got paperwork from the state of California classifying me as a chronic alcoholic. I'm a thoroughbred, man. I got paperwork. There is no denial about me being an alcoholic. I know I am an alcoholic. You know, I have no problem with that whatsoever. I know I'm an alcoholic. But that ain't the question. It's to my innermost self in here where I live, where no one else can see. What does that really mean? That I'm powerless over alcohol. It's not what you admit to your counselor or your sponsor or your wife or your husband or anyone. It's in here where you live, where no one else can see. What does that really mean, that you're powerless over alcohol? And I remember that day, God gave me a vision. It was just as crystal clear like watching a movie. And I remember that day my little girl was born. I can remember. It was like I was there, and they dropped her in my arms, and I felt that love. I felt that all-consuming love, knowing without a shadow of a doubt that I would have given my life for that child without a hesitation. Without even a hesitation, I would have given my life for that child. And it immediately went to that picture on that bus, watching this pathetic human being walk by, this little starving girl that I knew. I am powerless over alcohol. I will steal the food out of my child's mouth for another drink. If it comes to my drinking or her living, my drinking is going to come first. And I knew that to the very bottom of my soul, and it was humiliating. And it scared me. Scared me more than anything that had ever scared me before, how powerful that alcohol was. I'm not just powerless. Alcohol was my master. Absolute, total master. And I had to do exactly what it told me to do every single day. And what it told me to do every single day was to get me some more. And when I got some more, it said, get me some more. I don't care how you get it. Get it. I'll tell you where you can go. I'll tell you how far you can go. I can tell you who you can be with. I'll tell you when you can lay down. I'll tell you when you got to get up. I'll run every aspect of your life, and you have no decisions to make in anything. And alcohol owned me, and I got scared, man, because I got to that next part. It says that no human power was ever going to fix me. I kept hoping some treatment center was going to fix me. I kept hoping some woman was going to fix me. Some of you tried. You should have listened to your sponsor. Stay away from these new guys. Good Lord, you'll poke your eye out. And that left me one thing, man. I got on it. I thought about the people who had what I wanted, and it wasn't their money, their women, or their stuff, man. It was a look in their eye and the way they walked through life one day at a time on the sunny side of the street, no matter what was going on. And all these people talked about that same thing. They talked about that power. And that was my moment of desperation, and I knew there was a way out, and I dropped to my knees. And I cried out to a God that I didn't even believe in. And I said, I don't know who you are, and I don't know what you are, and I sure hope it don't make no difference, but I will do anything that you put in front of me if I don't have to drink today. And if you're not there, I'm screwed. And I'm God's favorite child. I don't even have the vocabulary to tell you what happened to me. But a knowing with all capital letters came over me, and a calmness of spirit. And something enveloped me, and I knew with every fiber of my being that I wasn't going to have to drink that day if I could hold on to that. So I got over to Charlie Tuck's house. Where else am I going to go? And I knocked on his door, and his Saint Edie, his wife, a member of Al-Anon, 44 years, just a wonderful woman. And I opened, she knocked on that door, and she saw me, and she just goes, oh, Kip, oh, God. Charlie's going to be so excited. You're his favorite. I went, really? I found out she told everybody that, you know. No one ever needed to hear that more than I did that morning. She said, Kip, she says, why don't you go around to the back patio? Charlie will be out in just a minute. And she went out there and she brought me a cup of coffee. And she sat and talked with me for a few minutes, just, you know, just pleasantries. And sweet woman. Charlie came out, he sat down beside me. He says, good morning, Kip. He says, what can I do for you, son? I looked at him, he said, Charlie, I said, Charlie, I don't want to drink no more. He goes, yeah, you've been saying that for a long time. What's different? I go, I don't know. I said, I don't want to drink no more. I'll do anything. I'll do absolutely anything you tell me to do if I don't have to drink. I don't want to drink no more, Charlie. I don't want to feel like this no more, Charlie. He looked at me, and he looked at me for a long time, and he says, Kip, he says, I got some good news, and I got some bad news for you, son. People like you don't get sober. People like you die in institutions. You die on the side of the road. They don't even write your name down. Something badly broken inside of you, son. I don't know what that is, but it's between you and God. The good news is this. I've been around here for a long time, and I can see in your eyes, I can see that little tiny little sparkle. And I know God has knocked on your door. He goes, here's the way it's going to have to be, Kip. Absolutely nothing. No woman, no job, no child, no absolutely nothing under this God's sun can ever become more important than you doing the things that you must do to maintain your sobriety. And son, that's a lot more than just going to AA meetings. You willing to do that? I said, Charlie, I'll do anything you tell me to do. He says, good, follow me. And it was Mother's Day. And he lived right across from this little park, you know, and all the families were in there with their families having picnics and stuff, and all these nice square citizens, you know, and they were all doing that mother thing. And, you know, and they walked right over amidst all these people. He dropped right down on his knees. And I looked at him. I said, what are you doing? He says, we're going to pray. I said, here? And I'm looking around. He says, Kip, these people have been stepping over you for years. He goes, you're on your knees, you're halfway to your feet, boy. He said, and let me tell you something right now, the only hope you got is God. That's the only hope you got. Now, if you're embarrassed of God right now already, don't waste my time or his. And he started to get back up. Man, I dropped to my knees. I said, wait a minute. He took my hands and he read that third step prayer out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had said it with him. He said, all right, come with me. And he took me over to this little, he had a little room in the back, and he was old school AA. He loved Norm Alpey. Him and Norm were real good friends, man. And he'd have 6 hours reel to reel of Norm Alpey. And he'd lay me in that room, man. The guys he sponsored would come over, man. And they started detoxing me on orange juice, Karo syrup, and a little bit of whiskey. And Norm Alpey. And I listened to Norm Alpey. And I listened to his guys come over. And they tell me their stories. And they took care of me. And they made me get a little bit of broth. And they'd hold me when I'd start shaking. They'd clean me when I'd throw up, you know. And they guys just took care of me. And they wound up just took turns coming and telling me their stories. 5 days sober, my sponsor came in. Charlie, he said, looked at me and he said, all right, son. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of action. Are you ready? I said, yes, sir. I said, what do I do? He said, get in the car. I thought that was the first step in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. I didn't get sober in AA meetings. I got sober in cars driving to AA meetings. And driving home from AA meetings with a bunch, couple old-timers up front and three dummies in the back, you know. And we'd listen to these guys talk, and we'd go to them where they were talking, you know. And he said, shut up and listen, you know. And I shut up and listen, and they'd give me, make me do stuff. They'd make me get jobs, and they'd make me work, and they would make me go get a haircut, and they would make me go to the Goodwill and buy some clean clothes, and they would make me go to meetings every single night, you know. And I said, well, you know, Charlie, I got 90 days. He said, so what? I said, well, he says, what's that supposed to mean? I went, 90 and 90. He goes, where the hell did you read that? Show it to me in the book. I said, I can't find it. He said, that's because it ain't there. I said, well, how long I go to these meetings? Till you like it. He said, you guys are going to brainwash me. I said, we can only hope. I had to be at a meeting of alcoholics every single night. I had to be there early to shake hands. I was a greeter at every meeting I went to. He said, shake hands with the women. You can hug the men. Don't borrow any money from anybody. Don't borrow any cigarettes from anybody. Don't tell anybody anything about you unless they ask. Ask how they're doing. And act like you care, you know, and you'll get to know people, you know. And I was at a meeting every single night, man. My first 8 years, I never missed one night. And that's the way my sponsor was. He taught me what the word commitment means in Alcoholics Anonymous, which just means something entirely different here than it does out to those normal people out there. Because, see, my life depends on my word today. It's not a matter of just, you know, I forgot. My sponsor said this. He says, when you take a commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous, first of all, understand that that is a responsibility. Understand that the word responsibility is two words. Do you have the ability to respond to the need? Do not take a coffee commitment if you don't have a car to get there with the coffee stuff. If you have to depend on someone else, that's not your commitment, that's theirs. You take something that you can do, that you're not setting yourself up for failure. And once you take it, the only excuse for not doing it is you died on the way there. Got it? I said, yes, sir. And that's the way it was. You know, he made me, just continuously, I have had to be in a study group studying the history of Alcoholics Anonymous from the first day I got here. He said, you stay in those book studies. That's where the winners are. That's where the seekers are. They're where you find your lifelong friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those people stick around. The people that want to whine and discuss the trivia of their day, they just come and go. Because look for the seekers. Stay with those people. Study our history so you know what we are, who we are, and what we're not. So when you're sponsoring someone, you can tell them the truth and not pollute this beautiful thing we have. You know, and things start happening in my life, man. I mean, I took a year sober. That was the most magic moment of my life. I never in a million years thought I could stay sober for 365 days in a row. And I did, and they gave me that cake, you know, and at 3 years sober, I started sponsoring a federal judge. Go figure. I'll tell you this, that it's absolutely impossible for Kip Collins to have a driver's license in the state of California. That's a 45-minute talk. I ain't going to go into it. But it is absolutely impossible for me to have a driver. I have one today, you know, because God put a judge in my life. And And, you know, and I helped him and he helped me, and what we could not do alone, we could do together, and, you know, and that's the way it's worked and ever since I got here, man. Anything, when it was time for me to need something, God put it right in my lap. When it was time. Not a minute before nor a minute after. That's the way it's been since I got here, and it's never changed. You know, I got all this stuff, man. I married a wonderful woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, named Connie, just a wonderful member, wonderful woman. And she got sober on exactly the same day I did, and she liked to fish. And she's sober on the same day. She likes to fish. Well, I mean, what else is there? You know, and we got married, you know, that was a good enough reason for me. You know, and I got custody of my kids. I still owned a bunch of commercial property with my ex-wife that I'd never done anything with, and she was out of it, man. She was running hard, and I gave her almost $1 million worth of commercial property, signed it over to her for custody of my children, and she did, and I got my kids. You know, and this woman, she had 3 kids, and I legally adopted those children. And 3 years sober, the state of California gave me a driver's license back. I came home, and there was a phone call, and this little girl, she goes, "Is your name Kip?" And I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Well, my name is Lori, and my mother was this so-and-so." And I went, "Wow, really? I knew her a long time ago." She goes, "I know." She goes, "You're my father, and I've been looking for you for a long time, and I want you to meet your grandchildren." You know, I'll tell you something, the hardest thing I've done here, it ain't been learning this A&A stuff. That's easy. It's been unlearning what I already knew when I walked in these rooms. That's the hardest thing you're ever going to do. Let me give you some psychological statistics. If you're 30 years old or close to it, whatever you're doing, you have an 80% probability of doing that the rest of your life. Because by the time you're 30 years old, you've established patterns in your life, and about 85% of all your actions, reactions, then inactions are automatic pilot. You don't even have to think about it, you just do it. And I've built up all these old ideas in the world I lived in because I needed those tools to survive out there. And I came in here with a lot of old ideas. And unlearning those has been painful, man. All of them are painful. I went to go meet my daughter. She wanted me to meet my grandchildren, man. I spent a lot of my life in correctional facilities in different places, man, and there was a color line in my life. You don't step across it. I don't look for no trouble, man, but I don't go there. I went to go get my, to prayed real hard because I didn't know what to do, man. And I went to go meet my daughter in a park, and my grandchildren got out of the car, and they're black. And my little granddaughter, she comes walking up to me, man. She's got my nose. Blue eyes, beautiful chocolate skin. She looks at me, man. She puts her hands on her hips. She looks at me. She goes, "You ain't my grandpa." "Are you?" I looked down at her. My heart exploded in my chest, man. I fell head over heels in love. I picked that girl up. I started loving on her. And God just washed all that nonsense right out of my heart, man.